Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Go ahead and say it, Jonathan.
I don't want to say it anymore. Get ready for Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. It's awesome.
I'm trying
to mess up your brand. I know what it's.
Welcome to the podcast. Today on the show, we have Jonathan Storman, who's a great preacher, but he is not a professional voiceover specialist like our friend Jennifer Green, who does our intro. But anyway, we're welcoming you to the show. And Jonathan, we are glad that you are with us today. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks, Luke.
That is easily the worst intro we've had to this whole thing. But Jonathan Storman is on the phone with us today. He did a great blog series entitled Civil Religions on his blog, which is jonathanstorman.com. And he had a quote on there that captured my attention. It was something I felt like we need to talk about. And it is this great quote from a website called Reddit. Now, Jonathan, does it make me seem like an old man because I've never been to the website Reddit?
No, probably just a more socially adept man. That you've never been to that website?
I don't even know what it is. Is it like a social media thing?
Well, it's kind of like a social media place for lots of different tribes. A lot of different people come with different interests. It's really kind of a place where a lot of people who struggle with faith or don't have faith or used to belong to religion, or there's ex-Mormons, there's ex-Christians, there's just about ex-everything, but that's where a lot of conversations happen, and that's where I found that quote. It was an atheist who was on the Christian part of Reddit, and he was upset with how Christians were talking to each other.
All right, well, let's just go ahead and read this quote. He says, "I wanted to let you know how it looks to the casual non-believing observer who looks past the fact that you're super nice to non-believers and wants to see how you actually treat each other. It tells me all I need to know, which is this. You'll be super nice to me as long as you're trying to recruit me. But once I join the club, I better fall in line or else. I honestly don't care what kind of votes this post gets because I'm done with this subreddit, but I wanted you to know that people notice how you treat each other. And it's the same in this subreddit as it is in real life. Open hostility strictly because of different opinions within the ranks of Christianity." When I read that, Jonathan, I felt completely dressed down. I felt like I was in the principal's office as a kid.
Yeah.
Not that I went there a whole lot, but I had been there a few times.
Sure.
Okay, so you read this quote, and does that kind of start this whole blog series that you're going to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of summarized one of the largest challenges that we have in a very connected world is we can't treat each other the way we've been treating each other. And I'm talking about Christians. Our disagreements, the way that we disavow one another so easily, because everybody can see that, and it's also quite un-Jesus-like and unkind.
So how do you then disagree with someone if we don't want to be hostile towards someone else who's also a Christ-following person?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question, and originally I was thinking that I wanted to address it for people inside churches first, because I want us to be able to do that to people who are outside of churches as well, who are in different political parties or different, hold different opinions about what would make the world a better place. It seems like the rhetoric is getting more and more angry these days, and I feel like churches have something that they could offer to what it looks like to have a kind conversation in disagreement with someone else.
Well, obviously, one of the more pressing disagreements found on the internet, this Mr. Donald Miller put out a blog post in which he talked about why he doesn't like to go to church. And it became this huge controversy. And let me just say this up front. I'm a little bit of a Donald Miller fanboy. I've read everything he's written. I've told his stories in my sermons. Sometimes I even quoted him in them. I've encouraged people to read his books. I've led like groups of college students through Blue Like Jazz. So I'm a big fan of his book, but his work. But I read that and I go, Donald, the spirituality that you're presenting seems like a very common narcissistic spiritual but not religious feel. Not saying everyone who's spiritual but not religious is narcissistic, and he just comes across just like that. And so, as a fan of Donald Miller and as a big fan of church, I hear this guy, this author who I like a lot, who I believe in his voice and his platform. I hear him say something like that, and I want to interject and say, this is not what we're all talking about here. Like, I might have signed up to read your books and to promote what you've done, but I'm not on the same bandwagon that you're going down. How do we as Christians be able to call like a Donald Miller out on something that we might not agree with without coming across as being that hostile group that this Reddit poster is talking about?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Because I disagree with Donald Miller as well, but I like him a lot.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm at the church I'm at now is because of his 1,000 Miles in a Million Years book. Wanted to live a good story, and I thought this was a great way to do that. You know, I think one of the things Christians have to be able to appreciate is the beauty of what Jesus did and how he did it. Guys, Son of God, he could, you know, reach in and change the world 1,000 different ways. But if this story is true, the Son of God gets together 12 very unlikely people and unlikable people, gets them to hang out with each other. He's like constantly correcting them. And I mean, they're jerks to one another. They're passive aggressive. They're stabbing each other in the back or doing all kinds of awful things. And he's getting them to sit at the same table together. And then after he's, you know, resurrected and ascended, he's like, hey, why don't you guys go start that all over the world? And I think the beauty of the Jesus story, it's big enough to say to, you know, Donald Miller or just about anybody in this story, there's a place at the table for you. I don't agree with you on this. I don't agree with you on, you know, your politics or your approach to what human flourishing should look like in the world, but because I love Jesus, I think you're a part of that, and I can't disavow you. And so I think being able to disagree with each other, because if you can't disagree, then it's not really community. But there is a sense in which being able to disagree in a way that brings unity instead of destroys it.
Yeah, I hear that. But what about the people who are trying to say, you're not even at the same table as me anymore?
Right.
Where you're going to say, this person's not even a Christian anymore because they have this belief on this one issue.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's obviously pretty common and probably what that Reddit person saw a lot. We try to carve up the world, and we use kind of a doctrine or whatever the hot button issue of the day is to say, if you're right on this, then you're right with God. And I think that's, you know, one of the more traditional Christian doctrines is you're not justified by works or your ideas or that. You're justified by Jesus, and so you don't get to draw that line, and I don't either. So I would hope that somebody who disagreed, you know, vehemently with me would also eventually be able to break bread with me.
You have this line from a Lutheran pastor named Maren Marti.
Mm-hmm.
I think he might be related to William Willimon, or at least their names have been equally influenced by each other. That's so bad. He says, or he made the observation that the people who care most about civility tend to be people with little conviction. Mm-hmm. And you say you don't, you hope that's not the case. But I think there's a lot of truth to that, because the people who are fighting most vehemently against what they would consider, you know, false doctrine or false teachers, these are the people who are saying, we've defined what you have to do to sit at this table. And it means you have to have these certain beliefs. And if you don't have them, then you're not even at the same table as me.
Yeah.
But if you have this, you know, laissez-faire attitude about, you know, theology or certain beliefs, it doesn't matter. Everyone's accepted at the table.
Right. Unless you don't think that everyone should be accepted at the table. And then all of a sudden those people find themselves somebody that they would like to exclude. I mean, that's kind of played out. There's always going to be somebody that you disagree with very sharply. And the test of any kind of group or movement will not be, can it get everybody to agree on everything? I think the real test is how do you treat the people who are outside, who you do disagree with? And, you know, I think we see this a lot. The kind of buzzword right now is tolerance. You can tell a lot about a person by what their take on that word tolerance is, but people who are very passionate about tolerance, they tend to be extremely intolerant about people who aren't tolerant, which is a confusing sentence, I know, but I think the big idea for what it means to be, you know, in communion with other Christians and be civil with convictions to the world is not that you're just basically saying, I'm okay, you're okay, everything's okay, because there is things in the world that need to be changed. There's evil in the world and in me, and I think Jesus and God want to address that. The problem is that we're not able to be seen or to be good for the people who don't agree with us. And I think that's internally in the church and externally how the church is perceived and a lot of times is in the world.
Yeah. Well, before we get to interacting with people outside, quote unquote, outside of the church in the world who disagree with maybe a church's stance on a certain issue, let's stay with the subject of people inside the church or people that we would all find ourselves claiming the name of Jesus.
Yeah.
You use a lot of the language of the table in that. What do you think the role is in the actual communion table and sharing meals in a more broader sense? What does that have to do with theological debates? Why is that a centerpiece to your response to disagreements?
Well, I mean, I think that's ultimately what Jesus did, was he gets together these people and has meals with them and gets them to see each other. I mean, one of the central things in the Gospel of Luke is Jesus having meals with people, but it's also that Jesus gets these people to have meals with each other. And you know, I'm from a tradition where we have communion every week, and there's something really powerful that happens there over the long haul, because I see people who have so little in common and disagree in so many different ways who break bread together. And a lot of it's symbolic, but it's more than symbolic. I mean, at the church that I preach at, we live in a city that has an Air Force base, and we also live in a city that has like three or four Christian colleges. And so we have people who are pacifist, and we have people who have given their life to serve in the military, and they take communion every week together. Every week I see people who have particular brokenness that I'm trying to think of how to say this. Every week I see somebody who has AIDS serve communion, a lot of times to someone whose son died of AIDS. And it's really powerful to see all these different kind of broken pieces, broken lives come together and break bread together. I think there's something about that we actually were confronted with, and we don't have everything together, and it gives us a little bit more humility in being able to respond to other people.
There's a group of church planners that I get together with every 2 months or so, and in that group are a few people that would probably theologically fit into a category of Christianity that I'm not typically a big fan of. And there's something inside of me that likes to build this scarecrow argument about that group of Christianity. And I want to think these certain things about them. But when I get together with them and we share a meal together, not like the communion meal, but an actual meal at a restaurant, talk with them, talk about what's going on in our churches, it's hard to have this fabricated understanding of them as the axis of all evil in church when they're your friends, when you actually are civil with them.
In Christina Cleveland's new book, Disunity in Christ, have you heard of that?
No, I haven't.
Okay, it's a great book. But she starts off she is an African-American young woman who has her doctorate. She works with churches and Christian movements all across America to try to help them become more diverse. And she starts off by talking about how when she first became a Christian, she joined this church, and she was in this like Bible class with this guy named Ben, who was the exact opposite of all things Christina was. She's more like socially progressive. He is very much conservative, theologically, socially. She is a black young woman. He is a white man who is rather privileged and has certain ideas about God. And she was constantly frustrated with Ben. And then it dawned on her that she was going to spend eternity with him, and he was going to spend eternity with her. And so she makes this move at the beginning of the book that I think is incredibly healthy for Christians to be able to do, and that is to recognize you're in this for the long haul. I mean, church is like practice. Church is filled with people who are passive-aggressive and rude and unkind. And, on our better days, we're great and we do noble things, but a lot of times we're not. And church is a way that we like let our rough edges rub off on each other. And, iron sharpens iron. There's going to be friction. So I like what she was doing there, because she's basically saying the kingdom of God is big enough for me and Ben. And I think that's what every church should struggle to embody.
Yeah, there's something different about being able to sit next to someone and to actually see them in the flesh compared to the experience someone has when they're having an internet-based discussion.
Right.
When you can sit behind a keyboard, it shows all these nasty things about you that you don't have to hide in person.
Mm-hmm.
But you can just say whatever you want without any repercussions because it's online. Here's a quote from a Christian blogger, a guy named Zach. I don't know how to say his last name. We're going to go with Hoagie. Maybe Zach Hoag is what we're going to go with. And he wrote this blog post about how he was quitting the progressive Christian internet for the year. That was what he was giving up for the year, which is an interesting thing to give up. He says this: in the name of feeling all the feels and being angry at my oppressors, the progressive Christian internet justifies unhealthy affect, arrogance, and aggression as normative, totally fine, and don't silence me. Being a online, we're going to say jerk, is now not an accidental slip. It's a virtue. And even tighter ideological circles are drawn until rigid cliques are formed, and everyone outside are the patriarchy or the racists or the oppressors. Often strange survivor-esque alliances are made to fight common online enemies, with bedfellows collaborating on badgering and intimidating their foes despite glaring contradictions in their own respective positions.
Dude, why didn't you interview him?
Well, that is a good question. I don't have his number,
or
actually.
Or the ability to say his last name.
Well, that's also probably why he doesn't want to talk to me, because I don't even know what his name is. But it's a great quote about the nature of having online discussions. And even if you cloak the internet in the Christian name, it's still the internet, and that medium is often very conducive for destructive relationships.
Yeah, that's right. It can be pretty dehumanizing. Some of my favorite people online who talk about, you know, ideas and following Jesus in this world are also people who are very invested in the local church. Like you interviewed Richard Beck a few weeks ago. We go to church together. And what a lot of people might not know about Richard is that he is so invested in the local church here. He, you know, drives the buses. He does jail ministry. Most of the things that happen, he's not writing about. But he also, he's, you know, working with some really big ideas. And I think the reason that I like Richard's writing so much, even when he pushes me and when we disagree, is I feel like Richard has faces behind the ideas that he's writing for. And it's real easy to lose that when you're, you know, writing in an overly connected world.
There's an elder from my church, and, you know, sometimes he pushes me to do some things that I'm not really enthusiastic to do. But what's underneath that is a history in which I've seen the sweat equity he has put into the church that we're a part of.
Yeah.
And so anything he says comes out of that relationship of trust and years of doing ministry together. And you don't have that when you're just typing on your computer.
That's right.
So you touched on the civil rights movement as an example of a way for the church to engage the culture on an issue in which there is a substantial disagreement over how things should be done.
Right.
Because the church will have those. Obviously, that was a big one that the church needed to make a stand on, and it's something that I'm proud of the Christian heritage I'm a part of for doing. It's great. So what are ways that we can learn, say, from that or other examples of how we can engage with the culture on something that is a substantial disagreement without destroying our witness of Jesus?
You know, I've read a lot of Dr. King biographies, listened to all the sermons I could, and tried to see as much of him publicly, because he kind of embodied exactly what we're talking about. The thing I love about Dr. King is that it was never only about justice for him, because justice by itself can be ugly. If you get to define what justice is, if you get to define what righteousness is, then you will most certainly be righteous. But what I loved about the civil rights movement was that it made the big grab. I mean, his letter from a Birmingham jail was him, you know, he was definitely confronting apathy and white church leaders, but he was doing it for their sake. And that came across in everything I saw publicly of Dr. King, able to be empathetic, kind of put himself in their shoes and imagine what this would feel like from someone who grew up in a place of power and privilege, and now all of a sudden the whole world seems like it's, you know, changing. You don't know how you're going to pass that on to your kids and grandkids. And so I think the two things that Dr. King did was he had a better imagination and he was empathetic. He was able to not just write people off who disagreed with him or, you know, condemned him. And that came through. And eventually it made the people that he was trying to convince empathetic as well. When you refuse to dehumanize the other, there's something really compelling about that. And I think behind all of that was the gospel and Dr. King's life.
Hmm. So imagination is a big part of being able to connect with someone when you disagree over a substantial issue. Now, isn't it Walter Wink who has the line about sin is a failure to imagine a different possibility? Isn't that who talked about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm totally familiar with everything that Walter Wink has written, so yes, that I think that's...
yeah. I was just checking.
Yeah, no.
But, okay, so talk to us about how if they're going to define sin as a failure to have an imagination of a different possibility, how can we be people who use imagination to help us work through disagreements?
You know, on just a really practical level, one of the things that I think I've heard, I can't remember where I've heard this, but it's definitely been true in my own life, is read fiction from time to time, because fiction helps you get in someone else's shoes and kind of view life outside of your own. And, you know, sin, the very nature of sin is to curve in on yourself and to be able to see with people that you have deep disagreements with where they're coming from, I think helps a lot in furthering the conversation. So, I mean, that's one practical tip I would say for fueling imagination.
As someone who's read a few of the Jack Reacher novels, I don't really think those are the kind of fiction you're talking about. I don't think he really does problem solving in the Christ-like manner. But the idea of having other ideas as ways to solve things, that's good. And empathy as a second part to learn from Dr. King about resolutions. How does empathy play a part in that?
Well, I think if you're able to sympathize with why someone feels or thinks the way they do. Sky Jathani in his new book, Futureville, was talking about how like 10 years ago he was at a conference in D.C. where it was on LGBT rights and like kind of future agenda stuff. And there were Christians in the room, there were LGBT Christians in the room, and there were people who weren't Christians but were very devoted to, and so they were basically trying to say, what can we do together going forward? And it was an off-the-record meeting, and Sky wrote that it was incredibly dark, and people were yelling and angry and very upset. And he said one of the things that stood out to him as he walked away from that meeting was that both groups of people were saying the future would be better if you weren't in it.
Wow.
And I don't think that's what we want to say to people. I don't think it's what we want to say to anybody. And I'm not just talking about Christians now. I think if we have to have a future built on the backs of other people not being in it, then I think that's unkind. But I do think it's the implication of the rhetoric of our day and the some of the ideas that we're saying. One of the things that's important is for churches to realize that in a pluralistic society, you're going to be judged by society by how you benefit the people who don't belong to you. And I think that's something we've got to start working on. Like, is the church good for the world? Is the church good for people who are never going to belong to her? Is the future going to be better because the church is in the world? I think that's a question a lot of people are asking.
You told a great story from Gladwell about lady who took over the juvie program in one of the boroughs of New York. And one of the things she did in her first year there is she had some 150 young adults, kids basically, in her program. And she took, along with the rest of her department, she took each one of them a turkey for Christmas.
Yeah.
And you reference this, and the point of what she was trying to do is that she was trying to give those people a different perception of the police. Part of what Gladwell goes on to say is that the majority of those young adults have only one impression of the police because the majority of their relatives are either in prison or have been in prison, and so they always think of the police as being against them.
That's right.
And she was trying to say, no, we're here for you. We want to help you out. So how does the church – obviously, we have the civil rights, which not everyone says, hey, that's a Christian activity. In a lot of ways, we don't see that as Americans as something the church led. instead, what the people see of the church is that we are against the gay community, that we're judgmental, that we're hypocritical. So how can we, instead of fighting for our issues, learn how to earn a platform in which we can show the world that we are for them, that we're not against them?
You know, two answers to that question. The first is, I think that we're extremely cynical. I mean, I deal with cynicism. I know a lot of my friends do. I think my generation is very cynical about church history, and we shouldn't be, because church history, it's got its you know, Crusades and Inquisition, but churches also started universities and libraries and orphanages, and monks created, you know, the cappuccino and, you know, saved civilization. And a cursory look at church history is that the church has been very good for the world. I mean,
hold on. Can you hold on for 1 second?
Yeah.
Did you say monks created cappuccinos?
Yeah. Capuchin monks are the ones who created the cappuccino. So you're welcome, world.
I think every hipster should be a Christian just because of that reason. What? You guys made cappuccino? I'm in. Okay.
Wait, everybody's in? Forget it. I'm out.
I was in before it was on the radio, though, so it's cool. Okay, so you're saying that the church has done some good stuff in our history.
Yeah. And I think it would be helpful for a lot of us to just become familiar with the history of the way God has worked to bless the world. But the second answer to that question is, I think we are drinking from wells that we have not dug, that our ancestors have dug. And so a lot of times when people hear today's church talking or engaging in, you know, debates on social media, they see that as divorced from, you know, the historical way the Jesus movement has blessed the world. Now, I don't, and I know you don't, Luke. We see people who are doing so many good things in the world. I think of the people at Highland, the church that I serve at, who are trying to be common good Jesus people for the city of Abilene. The problem is, I get a firsthand view of that. But a lot of the people who are, you know, just on our internets or cruising through the talk shows, they don't see that. What they see is people, you know, yelling.
Well, in a culture that's driven on sound bites and shocking statements, it's no surprise that those are the things that get the attention. If someone told me that if I wanted this podcast to reach a lot of people, is I need to get someone with name notoriety to say something that they're going to be embarrassed of saying.
Huh.
And that's how you build a platform. And I think that's how people work in a media-driven culture where you have 30 seconds of attention span. Yeah, you get something shocking on there, people will pay attention, but it's not going to ultimately further
right. The
message that we're really trying to communicate. And so I think there's some tension, because I think in a good relationship, like, you accept someone for where they are in life. And so you've got a friend, and they call you too much. They text you too much. It's annoying you. Okay. But you know what? You just accept them. That's who they are, and it's not your job to change them. But the message of what the gospel is doing is that there does need to be change that happens in my life, in our life, in our world. And so we're running this precarious balance of, we want to befriend people, we want to share life with them, but the message of Jesus is calling all of us to change, and that's a confrontational message. And so it's almost like we need to have as a baseline what you're talking about, stories
right.
that people know that we are for them, that we're invested in their lives, that we're doing things in our community to ultimately benefit them. Because if you're going to say a harsh word, it always needs to be connected with a loving action.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think a great example of that is Dan Caffey. Last year when the, you know, Chick-fil-A Day thing happened, and all of a sudden the world got carved up in like the course of 6 hours between people who were loving and people who ate at Chick-fil-A, or people who stood for truth and people who wouldn't eat at Chick-fil-A.
Yeah.
Basically, that was kind of the categories that I felt like was in my Facebook newsfeed. But it wasn't to the guy who owned Chick-fil-A. Obviously, Dan Caffey has been very public about his, you know, Christian faith and his commitment to kind of conservative social values. But he didn't just live in the sound bites. He, a couple of weeks later, after that whole thing kind of died down and it got out of the 24-hour news cycle, Huffington Post, did you see that story that came out?
Yeah, where he took a guy to a bowl game, right?
Yeah, he took him to the Chick-fil-A bowl game, and it was one of the like major leaders in the LGBT community, and the post was written by him. It was, you know, coming out of the closet as Dan Caffey's friend.
Wow.
And he said, you know, we're not going to agree on so many things, but Dan Caffey is a good man, and I know he loves me. And I thought, you know, I think that gets at the heart of what it is we're trying to do, to be able to be kind, to be able to lead with kindness, and to be a way of reconciliation. I mean, this current pope is not changing any doctrines. He's not going against any, you know, traditional church doctrines. What's changed is that he's led with kindness.
And he's become a rock star for it. He's on the cover of Rolling Stone, isn't he, this week or last week?
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, he is. People are drawn to what he's done. There was a beautiful picture of him embracing a gentleman who had some sort of skin ailment that disfigured him. And there's the Pope giving him a hug, kissing him on the forehead.
Yeah.
People see that and they're overwhelmed by it. It's very touching for all of us to see what he's doing. And it's a beautiful example of what we should all be about.
You know, one of the things that I think the Pope has done so well is I often find myself saying, God is for us. One of the things I wrestle with a lot is faith that we've been handed is a historic faith. I mean, it's, you know, thousands of years old. And if you believe that God is for us, then you believe that this faith is for human flourishing. And so much of the things when it gets carved up into conservative and liberal or however you want to say that, it seems like it's God is for certain people who the status quo works for, or God is for the marginalized, and so everything has to change. I think one of the challenges of being a part of a historic faith that has tradition that you think matters is we think that so much of what we've been handed from previous generations wasn't because God was trying to take something away from people, but that God was trying to say this is the best way for human flourishing. And I think the last couple of hundred years, the church has not talked about that. I mean, it's been like, don't do this because we said so, versus because this is the way God thinks, or God wired up the world, or how God is going to bring about human flourishing, or something like that. And I think those two things have been divorced from each other. Our ideas of sin and the idea of God wants the best for the world and for his people in it. And I mean his people, like everyone.
Yeah, all people. So if you had one chance to talk to this poster from Reddit who wrote this quote that we have based our discussion upon, do you have anything you would say to him?
Oh, man, that's a great question. I think I would just say, yeah, thanks for pointing that out, because you're exactly right. To which you would say, see, that's what I'm talking about. You're so nice to the people on the outside. But he's right. I mean, the thing Jesus wanted us to be known by was loving each other. And he's praying that for people who he spent 3.5 years with who were not very loving to each other.
Especially that one who, you know, tried to kill him and kind of did.
Right.
That's nice of Jesus to be loving to everyone, so maybe we should too. Now, Jonathan, we're at the point of the show in which we like to dispel rumors, because it's not newsworthy if it's not true.
Okay.
And so one of the things that we try to do at Newsworthy with Norrisworthy is give people an opportunity to say true or false to a rumor that's floating around about them. And so there is a rumor about you that I feel like we should discuss. Would you like to participate in this rumor dispelling session?
Sure.
Okay. We've had on the show a gentleman named Shane Hipps, who used to work side by side with a rather infamous Christian leader, speaker, preacher, Rob Bell. Have you ever heard of him?
Yeah, it rings a bell.
Yeah, Roberto Bell is what some people refer to him as. So there's a rumor that you actually used to work very closely with Mr. Rob Bell. True or false?
Yeah, kind of in the same way that stalkers work closely with their victims.
How so, Jonathan? How did you work? How were you a stalker for Rob Bell?
I've listened to Rob Bell's sermons for years, so I had a kind of season of grieving when he retired from Mars Hill. At one point, somebody walked up to me after a sermon like 8 years ago when I was preaching as the associate at a church in Fort Worth. And this middle-aged woman just walked up to me and said, "Numa," and walked away.
That's all she said? She just walked up and said, "Numa."
Yeah, that was it. That was it.
What do you respond to that?
Thank you.
Thanks.
But we were both pulling from the same resource of a guy named Ray Vanderlyn on that one. So
yeah, there you go. So did you work with Rob Bell or not?
No, I did not work with Rob Bell.
Oh, okay.
I got a cease and desist letter one time from Zondervan about Rob Bell.
Do tell. That sounds very newsworthy. You got a cease and desist letter.
When I was at the church in Fort Worth, we made a video on generosity, and it was like everybody was making those kind of Numa-like videos, and so I put it on YouTube as like Numa-like generosity. And anyway, so they were like, "Hey, cool video. You can't use the phrase Numa, which is like the Greek word for spirit." So I didn't know that they had trademarked that, but anyway.
It's all right. They did. Well, I'm sorry that you didn't work as closely with Mr. Bell as some of the other friends of the Newsworthy of Northworthy podcast.
I'm hoping this podcast reaches him and he decides to let me into the fold and we start doing Oprah work together.
You know what we're going to try to do here at Newsworthy of Northworthy? We're going to try to set up a reconciliation where you and Rob can just bury the hatchet and go surf together and... you know, live together a happy life shared in friendship.
That sounds amazing.
Okay, I'll put the call in and I'll get back with you on that.
All right.
All right? Hey, thanks for coming on the show, Jonathan. Really
thanks,
appreciate
Luke.
It.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.